Welcome to Trinity Forum Conversations. I'm Cherie Harder, the president of the Trinity Forum, and with me today is Eric Metaxas, the author of the recent released biographical work Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, and Spy, which was just released by Thomas Nelson on April 9th, the 65th anniversary of the death of theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I'm proud to note that Eric also wrote the introduction to Trinity Forum's recent reading on Bonhoeffer, entitled Who Stands Fast? Eric is also the author of the William Wilberforce biography, Amazing Grace, which was made into a major motion picture of the same title, as well as the literary tour de force behind the beloved children's book and video series, Veggie Tales, where he co-wrote such classics as Lyle, the Kindly Viking, Even Fish Slappers Deserve a Second Chance, along with the celebrated work, The Pirates Who Usually Don't Do Anything. When Eric is not providing moral instruction and belly laughs to children, he writes for the Atlantic Monthly and New York Times, appears frequently as a cultural commentator on CNN and Fox, and serves as the founder and host of Socrates in the City, a monthly conversation program in New York City on, in his words, life, God, and other small topics. He is also the author of Everything You Always Wanted to Know About God But Were Afraid to Ask, along with a sequel, aptly entitled Everything Else You Wanted to Know About God But Were Afraid to Ask. And today he joins us to talk about everything we'd like to know about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Eric, thanks for coming today.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
You've written quite a few books on a variety of subjects. Why Bonhoeffer?
Well, it's sort of easy to answer that question. First of all, I never intended to write a biography in my life. It was never an ambition I had. I've had many ambitions, most of them literary, but never to write a biography. But actually, when the movie was coming out, the Wilberforce movie, people often introduce me, as you just did, as the person who wrote the book upon which the movie was based. But in fact, the movie was being made. It was just about done when someone at HarperCollins thought, you know, when the movie comes out, there ought to be a new biography of Wilberforce because people will see the movie and they won't know, they want to know more about Wilberforce. So they came to me and asked me, did I want to write the biography of Wilberforce for $8 an hour? That's not true, but my agent got $8.40. But actually, I never thought that I'd want to write a biography, but Wilberforce is certainly one of my heroes, thanks to our friend Oz Guinness and Chuck Colson, for whom I worked. So I thought, okay, I will consider this. And I considered it, and I wrote the book. And sure enough, after I wrote the book, everyone said to me, Eric, who are you going to write about next? And I said, well, I never intended to write one biography, so I certainly don't intend to write a second biography, but thanks for asking. So people kept asking me, who would you write about? And I thought, there's only one person who's ever lived besides Wilberforce about whom I would like to write a biography. And that person, without any question, is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The story of Bonhoeffer, like the story of Wilberforce, is deeply compelling to me. I really feel that the two of them, in a way that's unique to the two of them, represent a kind of model of what it is to live a Christian life, to be in the world and not of it. There's an additional piece with Bonhoeffer, which actually is a very big piece. It's a very personal story for me. My grandfather was killed in the war in 1944, a German, unwilling German soldier. My mother grew up having lost her father at age 9 in the war. So the Nazis in that period have always haunted me. It's cast a shadow over our family, and it's something I've thought about a lot. So when I first heard about the story of Bonhoeffer, actually in 1988, through the man who led me to faith, I said, this is an extraordinary story, and I'd love to make a movie or love to, sometime in the future, somebody needs to do something with this. So finally, when people kept asking me, who's your next book going to be about? I said, well, it seems to me that it has to be about Bonhoeffer. And as I've written the book, the more I got into it, the more I felt that there was a deep sense. I felt a deep sense that I had been created to write this book, that there's an inevitability to it. Now, having written it, I feel, how could I have not written it? So that's the long answer to how I came to write this book.
Yours is actually the first book-length biography of Bonhoeffer in 40 years, despite the fact that many of his books, such as Cost of Discipleship and Life Together, are devotional classics. Why do you think there hasn't been more interest in at least a biographical aspect of his life? Do you think there was a need for some historical distance there?
I think a few things. I think, first of all, there have been some biographies, short biographies, written about him in the last 40 years, but there hasn't been anything close to a big biography, a real biography. The reason for that, probably, there are a few reasons, but the principal one is that the biography written by Eberhard Bethge, who was Bonhoeffer's best friend and who is the man who brought Bonhoeffer to the world, who really was the shepherding Bonhoeffer's legacy for six decades. Eberhard Bethge wrote this reference work, this Urtext, which came out in 1970 in English, written in 67. And that was so monumental and so inclusive and definitive that I think most sane people thought, what can I possibly add to that? The fact is, however, that in the last 20 years in particular, a number of things have come out that would warrant a revisiting of the subject. One is that a book came out in 1992 called Love Letters from Cell 92, which is the epistolary record of his romance with Maria von Wedemeyer, the woman to whom he became engaged. It's an amazing story. The book of letters doesn't really do it justice in some ways, in the sense that you kind of have to really be very familiar with the subject for these letters to make total sense. It's not as easy to follow the narrative, I mean, of their romance. It's not as easy to follow as it might be. So I thought, in my book, I will get for the first time to tell this story fully, the story of their romance, which, you know, most people, certainly most women, are very, very interested in. And it's a very interesting story. So I thought, what a privilege that I get to put that on my book. There are a number of other things that, or let me say this. Bethge, when he wrote his book, was very close to a lot of the other Bonhoeffer people, and probably would have felt like he's treading on their toes if he had included material from their books. It's one of those kind of turf wars things. Everybody has to respect everyone. But, you know, 40 years later, it doesn't really matter. Whatever's out there, you can use. And I thought, let me just take everything that's been in all these different books and incorporate it into my books. There's a wonderful book called I Knew Dietrich Bonhoeffer, which has all these recollections, friends who knew Bonhoeffer. I was able to sort of steal passages and things because that book has gone out of print a long, long, long time ago. And there are these delightful little pieces which are not in the Bethge biography. And there are a number of books like that where I found these little gems. Then finally, Dietrich Bonhoeffer Works, which is this outrageous, amazing 16-volume set of everything, volumes that he ever wrote, Bonhoeffer's journals, letters, everything, has been translated over the years into English, not completely, but almost everything. So I had that to work with. My German is not good enough where I would have been able to quickly work through the German stuff. I was able to use material from those books, and you know, your average person is not going to read the 16 volumes to find these nuggets and these gems, but I was able to do that and able to find so much wonderful stuff, pieces of letters and things, and put that in my book. So I'd like to think that my book has in it sort of everything that's interesting, entertaining, provocative about Bonhoeffer. Everything that's out there that I was able to sort of pull together is between the covers of my book. So, you know, 40 years later, it was perhaps time for that.
Mm-hmm. In reading your book, I thought it was interesting to note that Bonhoeffer, who was by any account a prodigy as a theologian, came from a family that wasn't particularly churched. His mother was clearly a woman of faith, but his father, I believe you said, was agnostic. What influence do you think his family had on his decision to pursue theology?
The reason Bonhoeffer chose theology is a little bit complicated. First of all, what's not said very much is that Bonhoeffer's maternal grandfather and maternal great-grandfather were pretty big deal theologians. The three elder Bonhoeffer boys, because Dietrich Bonhoeffer was the youngest of the four boys, they sort of followed in their father's footsteps, even their coloring. They have the dark coloring of the Bonhoeffer family. Dietrich Bonhoeffer followed a little bit more in his mother's footsteps. He has her flaxen-colored hair and blue eyes. And in a funny way, well, as I say, follows in the footsteps of her and her father and grandfather in going into theology. But there's more to it than that. I think that Bonhoeffer also wanted to distinguish himself from his brothers who were so accomplished. One of them went into physics and split the atom with Max Planck and Einstein. The other one was a top figure in jurisprudence, worked for the top legal advisor to Lufthansa. They were all very, very impressive in the world of sciences. And I think somehow he thought he could distinguish himself by distinguishing himself in the world of theology. But it was not easy for him. I think it's pretty clear that his brothers mocked him a little bit. This was not the thing to do in the Bonhoeffer family. But I think he really felt a desire to do that, to distinguish himself. But finally, he was, it seems, early on in his life, turned toward God. Because he was one of the three youngest of the eight siblings, his upbringing was slightly different from, as I said, the older boys, and he and the other his twin sister Sabina and his youngest sister Susanna, they were raised a little bit more by these two governesses who had roots in the Herrnhuter movement, the Moravian Brethren. They were sort of pietists, and I think that really had an effect on Bonhoeffer growing up. That somehow he knew about God in a way that his elder siblings did not. I also think that when Bonhoeffer's brother was killed in the third brother, Walter, was killed in the First World War, at that time something seemed to happen in the family. Dietrich was 12, and it seems that if anything pushed him to think more about God, more about eternal questions, it was the death of his dear brother Walter. It really crushed the whole family. It devastated the mother. She was practically bedridden for a year with grief. I think that is finally what turned him, aside from all these other things. He seems really to have decided when he was 13, and he declared it publicly just when he turned 14. His brothers, as I said, made fun of him, and they said, you know, why are you wasting your brain, this Bonhoeffer mind, talent, culture on the church? It's this corrupt institution, and what a waste. And he replied, probably only semi-facetiously, he replied, well, then I shall reform it. In fact, his legacy, in retrospect, seems to have come closer to that, and is still closer to that, to this idea of a reformer in all of his works, than maybe he intended when he made that comment as a young man.
You note in the book that one of Bonhoeffer's friends and mentors was the theologian Karl Barth. How did that friendship come to be, and what influence did Barth play in the formation of Bonhoeffer's own theological views?
Well, Barth was not a theological liberal. And Bonhoeffer was living in a world in Berlin, at Berlin University, that was ruled by the great theological liberals of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, Schleiermacher and then Harnack, under whom Bonhoeffer studied and with whom Bonhoeffer commuted on the trolley in from their neighborhood. You know, these were the big figures, and Bonhoeffer in some ways had to deal with that. Barth opened his eyes to a new world, a world of great theology, where God was taken seriously as someone who exists, as the eternal other, as opposed to somebody who's a little bit besides the point. Harnack thought God was a little bit besides the point, in the same way that a scientist might say, well, we can't talk about God, we're talking about science. Harnack and the theologians that Bonhoeffer was studying under would have felt the same way. They thought, our job is to do theology. What does God have to do with theology? I mean, I really think that they really would have said that and thought that, that we're to study the texts, we're to look at what we know. When Bonhoeffer discovered Barth, he thought, wow, here's somebody who really believes God exists and who believes God is revealing himself through these words that we're studying. These are not just words, but these are somehow conduits for this self-revealing God, this eternal other who wants to communicate with us. So Bonhoeffer pretty quickly became a Barthian and was very intellectually independent. It's kind of funny, this cocky, young, brilliant man who knew what he wanted and knew really that he disagreed with these geniuses under whom he was studying. So Bart was, from a distance, his mentor. Bonhoeffer finally had the high privilege of meeting Karl Barth in 1931, when he returned from New York City. His friend whom he'd made at Union, Erwin Sutz, who was a Swiss friend, introduced him to Bart. So he met Bart and became friends with Bart. And Bart, in some ways, was a mentor to him. They were friends. It's safe to say that they were friends for the rest of their rest of Bonhoeffer's life.
One of the great shames of Christendom is the complicity of so many German churches in the rise of National Socialism. What do you think led to such a shameful lack of resistance on the part of so many churches to the regime?
This is another question that's pretty complicated to answer. There, in my book, I would hope I answer all of these questions and more. That they need. They need sort of long answers, because there is so much to it. To try to answer these questions is very difficult. This one is one of the more difficult ones, in that there is no one answer. There's probably five answers. One piece of it, which I found very interesting and which I hadn't read in other places, but what seems right to me, is that there was a lot of spiritual pride in Germany. Germans, rightfully, because a lot of pride is based on facts, right? So the Germans thought, hey, we practically invented Protestantism. So you know what? We've got it all figured out. Luther is a god. Oh, of course, we don't worship him as a god. But in fact, they did. I mean, they really treated him as someone who had effectively invented Christianity, if you were a Protestant. And Germans, you know, were Lutherans. Luther was German. They had, I think, a lack of self-consciousness and a lack of spiritual humility to some extent. They weren't as self-questioning as one needs to be to really be a Christian. And so that's a piece of it. And again, I talk about all these different things in the book, but another piece of it is that Germany had, for good or for ill, in this case, very much for ill, a tradition of conflating church and state. The authority of the Kaiser and the Kirche, the crown and the church, was conflated and united. And it was a part of, let's be fair, it's part of what made Germany great. It's part of what made many Germans proud to be Germans, was this tradition. But when it came to the Weimar Republic, when they came to a place in history where they were required to think this through, many of them were incapable of thinking it through. They simply they hadn't done the theology in advance, and now it was too late. It's also important to understand that the Lutheran tradition itself, obviously going back to Luther, had a very strong emphasis, an overemphasis on Romans 13, on the obedience to worldly authorities. So this was a real Achilles heel for Germany. So when the time came to think clearly, they were unable to think clearly. There was also, of course, a lot of sloppy theology that you have today in America, that just people who are sloppy theologically and who can be fooled and are being fooled today and were fooled then and will always be fooled. When you don't know your theology well enough, you don't know the scripture well enough, when you don't know Jesus personally, you are you're going to potentially be open to being fooled. And they were just very ripe for being fooled, and they were fooled.
You note in your biography that Bonhoeffer was at the forefront of a movement of Christians who called themselves the Confessing Church, that challenged the clerical establishment and eventually challenged the Nazis as well, although perhaps not to the extent that Bonhoeffer would have advocated. How did this movement form, and what effect did they eventually have?
Well, the Confessing Church is fascinating. Bonhoeffer was one of the leaders, as you say, in the Confessing Church. They knew, people I think who were the most serious Christians, knew pretty quickly that the National Socialists were in the business of taking over everything, not just the government, they weren't just in the business of taking over too much. They were in the business of taking over absolutely everything. They'd had a worldview which did not allow for anything to exist that was not under National Socialist philosophy, or that did not, they called it Gleichschaltung, the synchronization of everything in culture. And of course, for them, the church was just another piece of culture. So the Nazis were aggressive in that. The people who were the leaders in the Confessing Church understood that this is wrong, theologically wrong. This is untenable. This cannot work with Christianity. Many of the people in the Confessing Church, the leaders, including even Niemöller, didn't understand that Hitler and the top Nazis were really behind this. They thought it was just bad theologians who were also Nazis. They didn't understand that the very leadership of the Nazi Party itself wanted to take over the church, to do away with the church, really, to transmute the church into from gold into lead. And the Confessing Church was always a step behind. Bonhoeffer was always in the front, sort of pulling them like a stubborn donkey or something, saying, "Come on, come on, come on. We've got to get ahead of the Nazis. They continue to outflank us. They continue to outstrip us. And we've got to get ahead and draw a bright line in the sand and fight on this line." Bonhoeffer was frustrated. He was really a prophet, a Cassandra in some ways, and a Jeremiah, more a Jeremiah than a Cassandra. But he was really one of the leaders who was even ahead, as I say, of the Confessing Church, and trying to get them to understand that we cannot make peace with the Nazis, we cannot make peace with the Reich Church, we've got to be more combative. So that's a long story.
Your biography quoted Bonhoeffer as declaring that only he who cries out for the Jews may sing Gregorian chants. I mean, that clearly flies in the face of much of what's associated with Luther's thinking. What do you think Bonhoeffer meant by that?
Well, first of all, on the subject of Luther, and again, I go into this in the book at length, because there are many of these things that they're so seemingly incomprehensible. They're certainly very, very deep, and they require real understanding. Otherwise, the whole thing becomes a real surface activity, because these are big, big questions which led to big, big, big problems. Luther, just to deal with him really briefly, my take on him is that he was an extraordinarily cranky person, and toward the end of his life, he got sicker and sicker and sicker, and he effectively became insane and said things on any number of subjects which, taken out of the context of his entire life and oeuvre, are deeply disturbing. The worst, the most disturbing, are the things that Luther said about the Jews right at the end of his life. But they fly in the face of things that he said about the Jews on the opposite end of the spectrum, positive, gracious things that he said early in life. So you have to put that in context. I think it's safe to say that Bonhoeffer and the others in his circle were totally unaware of the anti-Semitic ravings of Luther's latest years. So that's number one. But Bonhoeffer, totally separate from Luther, came to understand, his theology led him there, that we have to, as Christians, stand with the Jews as God's people. That's pretty radical. But he didn't get there intuitively. It was something that he was a theologian in the way that his father was a scientist. He was utterly logical about it, and he felt that the theology led one to the place that it was impossible as a Christian not to stand up for someone who was being persecuted. He said that Jesus Christ is the man for others, and the others in Germany at that time were inevitably, clearly, the Jews of Germany. And Bonhoeffer felt a very clear call to stand up for them. Bonhoeffer was disturbed at the gutlessness, at the cowardice of a lot of his brethren in the church regarding the Jews there. And again, their theology was sloppy. It's really interesting. They thought, in many ways, we in America thought the same thing about Blacks. We thought, well, it's okay for them to be separate but equal. Why can't they have their own church? I don't think they should worship with me in my church. I'm not saying they can't be Christians. Well, there were many German Christians who had so imbibed the worldview of the day, which was based on a racial view of the universe, that somehow being Jewish meant that you're in your own world, and you've got your own, you can have your own church, you can do what you like if you believe as a Christian. But Bonhoeffer understood that the very nature of the Church of Jesus Christ stands against that. So for him, it was very clear that unless you're willing to stand up for the Jews when they need to be stood up for, you can hardly call yourself a Christian. On what basis do you call yourself a Christian? How do you expect to be taken seriously by your fellow Christians, and how do you expect to be taken seriously by God? So don't worship him if you're not willing to stand up for the Jews. So that's when he made that rather famous statement.
Your comparison of the German anti-Semitism to the bigotry that we've seen in our own country is interesting, in that you note that Bonhoeffer, when he came to the States, was not at all impressed with American seminaries, but left extremely impressed with African-American churches.
There's no question, and again, I hope I make this extremely clear in the book, because this is such an important aspect of his whole life and career. But when he came to Union Theological Seminary in 1930 and 31, he was completely unimpressed by the theology at Union. He hardly got anything out of it, theologically speaking. He was there in some ways just because he wanted to kill a year before he could go back to Berlin and get ordained, and he thought it'll be a culturally broadening experience. But he could have taught at Union. He could have taught circles around half the people who were teaching there. He was way ahead of them. He was from Berlin, the center of the universe in terms of theology. So he was sort of bored by them theologically, and I think he was really shocked at the unthinking theological liberalism. He disagreed with theological liberalism in Berlin, but it was thinking theological liberalism. It was brilliant theological liberalism, even if its conclusions were different than Bonhoeffer's. But here in the United States, he found a theological liberalism that only set itself up in kind of a sloppy way as the antithesis to fundamentalism. But Bonhoeffer thought the fundamentalists know the Bible and theology better than the folks at Union. So he was really unimpressed by what passed for theology, and certainly about what he heard preached in the Protestant mainstream white churches. It was lukewarm social gospel liberalism, and he was not impressed. But a friend of his invited him, an African-American man named Frank Fisher, invited him up to a church in Harlem called Abyssinian Baptist Church, which was a congregation of African-Americans. And Bonhoeffer was completely blown away by the experience. Here, for the first time in his life, he saw solid, fiery, passionate gospel preaching. He saw lives that had been transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ. He saw social outreach that was combined with evangelism and good theology and Bible study. He was hugely impressed. He was mostly impressed by the worship, which was unlike anything he'd seen in Germany or at Union or in those mainstream white Protestant circles. It really changed him. He scoured the record shops of Greenwich Village to find recordings. And he came back to Germany rather a changed man. He actually went so far, I think he overstated it, but to say that he really wasn't a Christian before that. That seems to be untrue. But you can see that his devotion to Jesus first came about in this deeper way that would be with him for the rest of his life, it seems, at Abyssinian Baptist Church. He saw a people who suffered, a suffering congregation, people who, many of whom had been alive during slavery times. He saw something different. This was when his heart, I think, turned toward Jesus in a way that it had not previously turned, and he was never the same.
One of Bonhoeffer's most intriguing yet criticized ideas is that of religionless Christianity. Can you tell us a little bit more about what he meant by that?
I'm very glad you asked that question, because it comes up every single time, and if ever anyone was misunderstood, Bonhoeffer was misunderstood, especially on this phrase. He really never said it. I mean, I shouldn't say he never said it, but he wrote it in a letter, a private letter, to his best friend. He never intended these letters to be seen by anyone except his best friend, who was a genius and who understood Bonhoeffer. They were like soulmates. But, of course, because Bonhoeffer died, his best friend, Eberhard Bethge, felt, well, perhaps I can share these snippets of these letters because there's some interesting thoughts in here. And Bethge shared these things, and it's kind of like he let the horse out of the barn or the cat out of the bag. And theologians, especially some of the God is dead, more liberal theologians of the 50s and 60s, just grabbed this stuff and ran with it, and they ought never to have grabbed it in the first place, much less run with it. And they really created a kind of false theology based on these few little scraps that are utterly out of keeping with the rest of Bonhoeffer's life. It's almost funny if it wasn't so tragic, but Bethge, Eberhard Bethge, in 1967, spoke out against this. He spoke out against it more than once, but he made a famous statement, which I'm pretty sure I quote in my book, that the misuse of this little phrase, taken out of context, just has led to every kind of error and has created a hugely false legacy for Bonhoeffer. Most people, and this is another reason that I'm so extremely excited about this book, is that many people don't know Bonhoeffer at all. They have a very false idea of who he was. They think that he was just theologically off the farm. And as I say, theological liberals really did kind of hijack his legacy. And when you look at the facts, you say, something is very wrong here. And most of it is based on this phrase, religionless Christianity, which he put in one of these letters. All he meant by it, of course, if you know any Bonhoeffer, is that he was talking about how the church has failed and how religion in Germany has very little to do with Christianity, because otherwise we would have stood up for the Jews and the church didn't do that. And so he's talking about somehow we've got to move beyond this kind of dead religion and into a more vital Christianity, a Christianity which takes its place at the center of our lives, at the center of the whole culture. It was in fact precisely the opposite, ironically, of how some people interpreted it. And the funniest thing is, the day before Bonhoeffer was hanged, he performed a service. He performed a whole service as a minister. I mean, this idea that somehow he transcended religion, well, guess what? 18 hours before he's hanged, he's a minister performing a service for his fellow prisoners and reading the scripture and reading a sermon, giving a sermon and all these kinds of things. So this is just one of the most tragically misunderstood phrases in the history of phrases, I think. And to be able to set this to rights at length in the book is a great privilege and honor, and I really hope people will pay close attention to that, because it is an incredibly important issue, especially for Bonhoeffer, but for the church at large in America.
You note that Bonhoeffer at various times was criticized for participating in an assassination plot while as a pastor. But as you describe in the book, his path of action from conscientious objector to conspirator was quite a long one. How did he come to cross the line?
Of all the answers that I say this is in the book, this is the ultimate, because this is just very difficult to explain. And I think in the book I do about the best job of making sense of this that has been done. And that's not because I do a perfect job, but because not much has been done, it seems to me, on this, at least to my satisfaction. There are many pieces to this. First of all, Bonhoeffer has been in some ways hijacked, at least co-opted, by the theological liberals to the extent that he's painted as some kind of a pacifist. He was absolutely never a pacifist, by no stretch of the imagination. So if you think of him as a pacifist, his decision finally to get involved in the plot to kill Hitler seems like he just thought, oh, the heck with everything. Now we've got to get serious and roll up our sleeves. It was like it was some great departure or break from his previous theological life. It was not that at all. In fact, it was precisely the opposite. I think it was the final flowering of his deepest theological thinking, and it was an extension of the theological thinking he'd been doing since he was 17 years old. It followed from it. How he gets there, as I say, is complicated. Probably one answer to it is that he recognized in Hitler some kind of ultimate evil. He did not see someone with whom he simply differed. He, because of Bonhoeffer's family connections, he knew what was going on with the Jews when most Germans had no idea. Bonhoeffer knew, his family knew, they had very high connections in government circles. So he understood that we're dealing with a level of wickedness here which is unprecedented. And so if ever anything would call for this, this does. And I think it's if you think of somebody coming and breaking into your house and systematically stabbing or shooting your family members, would you get a gun and kill that person? Would that be self-defense? How would you define that? Well, you realize it's sort of complicated, but Bonhoeffer, he thought it through very, very carefully. It wasn't just something that he came to quickly or in any kind of unthinking way. He really thought it through. He thought, what is God leading me to this? He concluded finally that the Lord God was leading him into this conspiracy, that this conspiracy was not something that departed from being a holy Christian, but it was at the very essence of it, that a false piety, a false religion would be to say, well, thou shalt not kill, I don't ever. He thought, no, there are times when you actually have to go beyond principles and rules and think, is God saying something here God never contradicts himself, so clearly it's not that you dispense with rules, but there's a point at which rules end, and now you're in terra incognita. Bonhoeffer was in that theological terra incognita, where he said, we have no map, the rules do not tell us what to do, so we're not going against any rules. God forbid that I would ever do anything that would be against the scriptures, but I'm doing something where there are no rules and where I have two options. One option would be to pretend that the rules apply when they don't, which most Germans did. The other is to say there's got to be another way to figure this out. And of course, for Bonhoeffer, that was by revelation. He believed that God speaks to us and that you've got to have a personal relationship with God. You can't just have a relationship with these rules, but you've got to have a relationship with the God behind the rules, the author of the rules. Bonhoeffer had that kind of relationship, and he felt that to be a Christian is inevitably to have that sort of relationship with God so that you're able to hear directly from God, whatever that means. Bonhoeffer really felt that God was leading him carefully, slowly, but deliberately in this direction to be involved in the conspiracy. And finally, I'll say this, he was willing, and this gets at the real core of his theology, he was even willing to make a mistake if his heart was right before God. Now, in other words, if he thought, okay, I'm going to follow God and I'm going to do this because God's leaving me, if I'm wrong, if I am making a mistake, God's grace will cover it because he sees that my heart is to serve him, that I'm actually serving him. And a big piece of Bonhoeffer's theology, as I was just saying, is that he felt that dead religion is to live in this fear that says, okay, I've got to follow these rules, and if I follow these rules, I'll get into heaven. But he thought, no, it's not merely about following rules and about not sinning, because to not sin is not the be-all and end-all of being a Christian. To be a Christian is to follow and obey God, which is a positive thing as opposed to a negative, fearful thing that deals with simply avoiding sin. So to not kill Hitler is to sort of avoid the possibility of sin, but to actually get involved in this conspiracy is to act, it's to be proactive. And I write about this in the Trinity Forum reading. What Bonhoeffer felt he was doing was actively obeying God's call on his life. That's what it was to get involved in the plot to kill Hitler. It wasn't a pretty thing, but Bonhoeffer thought it is God's will. And so he really did feel clearly that he was hearing from God. So that's the shortest answer I can give on a very deep question. But as I say, in the book, I go into greater detail.
Oh, that's great. I mean, now we think of Bonhoeffer as a hero, and clearly he was a brilliant man, but this is also a very human man, a young man prone to depression whose life ended before 40, someone who valued community very highly, even wrote a book entitled Life Together, and then found himself cut off from most of his fellow churchmen and living the secret and fairly disorienting life of a double agent. How did he stand fast in the face of so much isolation and chaos?
Well, there are two things I would say to that. First, Bonhoeffer had this sense early on, even in the early 30s, that God had a particular call in his life and that he was somehow like the prophet Jeremiah, that he was an unwilling prophet. He was somebody that he didn't want God to grab him and to use him for this job, but if God called him, he would not say no. He could not say no to God. It's very much like Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus did not want to go to the cross. It's very clear he didn't want it, but he said, but thy will be done. That Father, this is your will. Bonhoeffer really had a sense that God was calling him to this lonely path of getting involved in the Abwehr, in this resistance, and in the conspiracy. And that if God called him, that was that. So there was some huge solace in that. He really knew that God was calling him to this path. And on a more practical level, I would say that Bonhoeffer was very self-disciplined about devotions, that he every day would meditate on the scriptures. He had a very, very seminal teaching in the seminary about meditating on the word every morning for a half hour, meditating on a particular scripture. And he lived this out himself, and he lived this out from the early 30s on to the very last days of his life. He would meditate on a scripture, pray, and allow God to speak to him through the scripture. It's extraordinary. He also would pray a lot, intercede a lot of Bible reading. But I really think that those things got him through on a more practical level.
It's now been 65 years since Bonhoeffer's death, and you are probably familiar with him in a way that few people beyond his contemporaries at the time were. Any lessons that his life holds for us today?
Bonhoeffer's life, in a way, is the lesson, and that's why I think it was so important to write a biography, because Bonhoeffer felt, theologically speaking, that one's life is one's theology. One may write theology, but if one does not manifest one's theology in one's life, in one's obedience to God, then one is a hypocrite. You cannot talk about theology only, you have to live it. So at the seminaries at Zingst and Finkenwalde, he was modeling Christian life. He said, you've got to model it. Jesus didn't merely teach the disciples, he lived among them. He was their leader. They looked to him. They observed him eating, talking, laughing, weeping. They lived with him. They saw his life. Bonhoeffer similarly felt that to be a Christian, one must live one's life among other Christians. One must learn from other Christians. One must teach other Christians. That's at the core of his theology. Incarnation was at the core of his theology. And so he really felt that one's whole life is what it is to be a Christian. It's not that I can teach you these eight principles or just memorize these scriptures, that the two go hand in hand. So for me, Bonhoeffer teaches us that you cannot separate your life from your theology. That's the shortest way of putting it. But I think that reading the story of his life, you really see that here's a man who was magnificently, I would even say uniquely integrated. I marveled time and time again at how his life was a constant response to what he believed, that he was somehow able to grow as a person in the same way that he grew as a theologian, that he was continually becoming more obedient to Jesus Christ, more obedient to this theology that he professed, and he was living it out and living it out. And it seems that there are few people alive at that time whom God could have called to this lonely path, who would have seen God in this call. Many people, I think, would have dismissed it. Their theology and their lives somehow couldn't keep up. But Bonhoeffer was up to it. God created him to be up to it. And he really shows us what that is, to live a life of obedience to God that really takes you way, way, way out on a limb and then on a branch and then way out on a twig so that you're saying, is God going to let me fall? But if you're following God, you know that he won't let you fall. And I really think that Bonhoeffer's life somehow is the greatest example that we have, certainly in modern times, of anyone who has lived like that. So I hope that people are deeply inspired in their walk with God through reading my book.
Thanks, Eric. We've been talking today with Eric Metaxas, author of Bonhoeffer, Pastor, Martyr, Prophet, and Spy. I'm Cherie Harder, and this has been a Trinity Forum Conversation.
This recording is copyright 2009 by the Trinity Forum. The Trinity Forum engages established and emerging leaders with the great ideas of civilization in the context of faith for personal and societal renewal. Since our founding in 1991, we have facilitated seminars, discussions, retreats, and lectures for thousands of leaders in North America, Europe, and Asia. These events feature opportunities for participation in profound reflection and candid conversation about life's most important issues. For more information about audio and print resources from the Trinity Forum or our worldwide events, please visit us on the web at thetrinityforum.org.